Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 221st edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a bi-weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. My guest today is Samah Abdurraqib. Samah was born in New York, grew up in Ohio, and in 2010 earned her PhD in English, specializing in women's studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She came to Maine as an assistant professor at Bowdoin College and also worked for the ACLU before taking her current post as the Community Engagement Coordinator for the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence. She joins me today to talk about her work to support vulnerable populations across the state of Maine. So thank you so much for being my guest today, Samah.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
You were the second oldest of four kids in your family growing
Yes.
up in Ohio.
Yeah.
And you became an academic, studying and then teaching English and women's studies. And that makes me wonder about your love of stories and books and poetry. Did you have a favorite children's story growing up?
Oh, children's story. You know, I was the kid who always did the summer reading programs through the library. You get the put all the stickers and then you go get like a Frosty or something from Wendy's. So,
yeah.
So that was me. I don't know my favorite children's story. I really like Virginia Hamilton. She was she wrote a lot of sci-fi stories for kids, and she was a Black author. And I love Justice and Her Brothers and that series of her in particular, that she wrote in particular. I also really like Walter Mosley when I was growing up. I remember my first like adult book that I read. I get my love of books from both my parents, but my house was full of books that my father's books. I get my love of stories from my mother. She loved fiction. And I think my first like adult book I ever read was Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. And it was my mother. I still have her copy. It was my mother's copy. And it was really powerful book, really painful story.
That's kind of the sweetest, right? To have your mother's
Yes.
copy of your favorite book.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your parents met because your mom worked at a bookstore, right?
That's how the story goes. She worked at a bookstore. My father would frequent that bookstore. And eventually he started to frequent that bookstore because she worked there. And that's,
they must
that's the
be so proud of you growing up to be such an academic when it was something they clearly valued themselves.
I think so. That's what, you know, my father's name is Idris and my mother's name is Serena. I think so. I hope so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What did you think you might like to be when you were a kid growing up? You grew up mostly in Ohio, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. I was going to be a doctor, an OBGYN for, you know, that was my focus for a very long time. And it wasn't until my junior year in college that I realized that, oh, wait a minute, maybe I don't want to do this. My mother was really excited for me to be an OBGYN. I remember being 7 years old and talking about going to med school. Except I was like really uncomfortable. I couldn't even say the word pregnant. I used to get so embarrassed about it at age 7. So, you know.
I remember being embarrassed to look at pregnant women.
Right? It's just when you're young, it's like,
right. It's different.
Yeah. So, yeah, so, you know, in college, I was like, I just realized I didn't want to really go to med school. And through college, I majored in English. And so that became my focus.
And let's just give a little shout out to English majors.
Yay.
We are so STEM focused. I shudder to think at the people who were born into this world to be something besides scientists. Mm. I love scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Love all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I love artists
mm-hmm.
and performers and readers and writers mm-hmm. and... So, yes, you can be anything when you're an English major.
That's right.
It's just
That's
the
right.
beginning of all the possibilities. Where do you think you got your passion for advocacy? Because you've taken your English major kind of in that direction over time.
Mm. Mm. Well, I grew up in a house that was very, very focused on Blackness, very focused on Black political life. And so I think that, so that part of me... started very young. My mother, she used to write when she was in school in New York City. She used to write for a Black Power student newspaper. So that's just something that was like in my blood.
I think that's so cool.
Right? I just recently found this out maybe 2 years ago. I had no idea. And it's it was a really powerful excavation process. That
did you read the article she'd written?
Yes.
And she's been gone a long time. So that's a wonderful way to know your mother's mind.
Right? Yes.
Beautiful.
Yes. I think excavation projects like that, where you're connecting to your ancestors, to your family, they're just really powerful and meaningful. So, but I think my feminism didn't kind of emerge until college, which I think is the norm for some folks. You know, I've told this story many times, but I had a friend who was sexually assaulted, and we decided to go. She wanted to go to a Take Back the Night rally, and I went, and it was so powerful, particularly on a campus like Ohio State University. It's a very large campus, very large Greek life. And we were, you know, marching down Fraternity Row, and people were joining us, and the speak out afterwards was just really inspiring. And so after that, I had a friend who worked at a domestic violence shelter in Columbus, Ohio, and she encouraged me to volunteer. So I volunteered for a year, and then I started working there before I went to grad school. And it changed my life.
Yeah, starting to accumulate those horrific stories and those heroic stories of bravery and recovery. And so you must have quite the encyclopedia after working on a hotline and working in centers.
Yeah, I mean, I think, now I don't do direct service work, and I think of all of our advocates all across the state who, support all of these folks through difficulty and foster resilience, help foster resilience in all the survivors they work with. And I just am very, I'm so grateful to be able to work alongside them.
Yes, and your work is really founded in story.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your job, about community engagement coordinator for the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence, and the state of our state when it comes to domestic violence prevention and responses?
Sure. So that title, community engagement coordinator, basically means that I coordinate several different projects. I work with advocates who work with trafficking survivors. I work with advocates who are doing work around economic abuse and economic empowerment. I think that's how we actually met. Yeah.
Yes.
I also do work around access, so language access, access for LGBTQ plus survivors and victims. And I do a little bit of interfaith work, so reaching out to clergy and to lay faith people. I'm working with advocates who do that work. I also, support our staff who works on policy and testifies at the State House and works with legislators. So it's, it's kind of like a hodgepodge, a very important work that keeps me always on my toes.
I bet.
We have, the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence is, it's a kind of like an umbrella organization, and none of us on staff do direct service work, but we support all of the advocates across the state. We call our member programs, we call them domestic violence resource centers, and we have 8 domestic violence resource centers across the state, and then we have one culturally specific and linguistically specific program that we work with. So our domestic violence resource centers cover several different regions, several different counties. I don't remember the reach of this program, but there's Caring Unlimited and serves York County through these doors, serves Cumberland County, Safe Voices serves the Tri-County area, Androscoggin, Franklin, Oxford counties. We also have Family Violence Project, New Hope, Hope and Justice Project, and Partners for Peace. Our culturally specific and linguistically specific program that we work with is the Immigrant Resource Center of Maine. They mostly serve survivors, African survivors who are coming from Africa. And
are they based in Lewiston?
They are based in Lewiston. Thank you. They're based in Lewiston. They serve that Tri-County area, but they also do some work here in Cumberland County in Portland. So they're the people they work with come from mostly Africa and Middle Eastern countries. This year, thus far, our member programs have served approximately 13,900 people.
My goodness.
That's not, you know, and so that means anyone who calls, anyone who uses shelter, anyone who works with our advocates who do, who provide court support, any survivors who are working with CPS and have Child Protective Services and have a CPS liaison that works at the resource center. So, you know, the services run the gamut. But thus far, approximately 13,900. And that, you know, at the end of the year, we'll have a fuller total. Approximately 185 of those folks we've served are people who identify as immigrants or refugees or asylum seekers. The Immigrant Resource Center of Maine, in 2014, they served 158 folks who identify.
These numbers are similar to the percentages of the people in the communities in which they live, it sounds like. So maybe there's not more domestic violence among the immigrant population.
Oh.
You're finding, but there are culturally specific supports
mm-hmm.
for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing immigrants are about 18% of Lewiston.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is a number I don't know. So,
yeah. So it doesn't, those numbers don't seem surprisingly different than, you know, Maine-born people.
I think that's a really important point, actually. I think that those of us who are not, those of us who are born here have ideas about other cultures and sometimes think or feel as if domestic violence is validated or justified in those cultures. And I think that that's an important thing to kind of interrupt. Because, you know, I look at our culture and I look at these numbers and I think, you know, we also live in a society where there's a lot of domestic violence. So
I had an Iraqi guest who had been a school teacher in Iraq, and she came here and was learning English as an older woman, part of NEAAO, and she's just wonderful. And she couldn't believe how violent our language is. We, you know, crushed the other team. We screeched to a halt. I don't know. I can't think of them off the top of my head. But she had a whole list of things that we say that just are jarring mm-hmm. to her ears. And I think when you think other cultures sanction violence, then you might be surprised that they're surprised by our violence.
Mm. That our MCDV's director, Francine Stark, has led us and some of our advocates through that an exercise where we think about the language that we use. There's so much, even thinking about, you know, you make a list and you put the little dots and we call those bullet points. So
it's just
so steeped in our language.
You're right. I love bullet points.
I sometimes don't know what else to call them. Dots. I'll make a dotted list.
Yeah, that's tricky. We're going to have to reinvent our language around that. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the federally funded part of your program. Mm. You know, I know that you're serving people all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even starting with, what exactly do you categorize as domestic violence, and does it cover everybody?
Mm. Yeah, so the way that we define domestic violence is that it is a pattern of behavior. That is at the base of that behavior is power and control. So someone is exerting power and control over their partner, over their former partner, and partner. I'm using that in a gender neutral way. We know that the rates of intimate partner violence or domestic violence among non heterosexual couples is similar to that to the rates in heterosexual couples. And it's, you know, the part of that kind of definition, that the pattern, talking about a pattern, is really important because this is not, it is not a one incident. you know, and so much of, if you look at the power and control wheel, that's something that so many folks are familiar with. The power and control wheel was developed in Duluth, Minnesota, in the, I think the early 80s. And it was developed from feedback from survivors talking about their experience. And so much of that power and control wheel is not physical violence.
It takes a lot of the personal out of it. You know, you think this was just a situation with you and your partner where he'd do that makeup and then be wonderful for a long time, but then he'd start criticizing you, and then, you know, it goes down from there. And you think that's just the cycle, you and your partner. But then you look at the wheel and realize this is the cycle, the cycle of violence.
Yeah. And, you know, that's, I think that the wheel is so important because it's not always this kind of cycle where it's, you know, there's an incident and then there's the makeup session and then there's, because what survivors have told us, told advocates, is that there, that those things are happening all the time, you know? So the, you know, the, maybe the name calling is happening all the time, or maybe the monitoring, how they're spending their money is happening all the time. There may be moments where things become more intense, but these things are just, they're just happening all the time.
Yeah. Right. So it's not totally on and totally off. Yeah, that's a great point. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Samah Abdurraqib. She's the Community Engagement Coordinator for Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence, operating out of Lewiston and Portland, and she teaches and coordinates services around the whole state. I wondered if you might paint a fictional story for us that would highlight the kinds of experiences immigrant families in particular might be facing in Maine. What are the needs that you're seeing with some regularity, and what services can people access through your organization? I mean, you've listed those before, but just in general, what might a trip through the system look like?
Yeah, so and I'm taking, when we're training our advocates, we always use de-identified situations, and we do like role plays. And so the information I'm giving, or the bits of the stories I'm giving that I've gotten from Immigrant Resource Center of Maine when they train their advocates, the kind of stories that they talk about. So
these are fictional then.
These are fictional.
But they portray a possible story.
Yeah. And honestly, I don't think that the situations are going to be any different. You may have someone who has children. This story that I'm reading from, the couple has 7 children together. They've been married for a long time, about 20 years. They came here to the U.S. They resettled in Maine after staying in a refugee camp for 10, 15 years. And they are experiencing what you might imagine, some culture shock, some financial difficulties, and the kids are having difficulty in school, things that you can imagine, right?
Yeah, sure.
And maybe someone is noticing that the kids are having difficulty in school, and they are not necessarily familiar with the parents, because maybe the parents don't have fluency in English and they're not they're not coming to the school and talking to the teachers. And so maybe someone makes a report because they're concerned that the children are being neglected. And so then that person has to figure out how to navigate all of those systems, right?
That would be making a report to DHHS, just making that anonymous phone call if someone's concerned. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Or you have a family who's, they've been here for a few years, and maybe the husband or the father in the family, maybe his behavior changes after coming here for any number of reasons. And maybe his anger is escalating, or his lashing out, or whatever, maybe his behavior is changing towards his partner, and the wife doesn't know what to do. Maybe she's talking to people in her community, and they're and they're telling her not to go to the police or anything like that. And so she's trying to figure out how to manage all those things.
Because she's afraid they might take her family mm-hmm. and separate them.
Yeah, so, you know, with any kind of situation where there's domestic violence, if the person who is the victim or survivor is marginalized in any way, then they are more vulnerable. So if either person in either scenario doesn't speak English, that makes them more vulnerable because they may not have access to the services as easily. Or maybe concerned because they don't know if those services will have interpreters.
But they do.
Yes, yes. We are mandated to make sure that our services are accessible. We are federally mandated to make sure that our services are accessible to all people.
So if someone who doesn't have English can call the hotline number.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how they would find it, but I like to know. I like to think that someone would help them find the phone number, and mm-hmm. then they can ask for a mm-hmm. translator, and the translator will get on the line,
mm-hmm.
and they'll get the crisis line help in right. their native language translated.
Right. So we work with an interpretive services, an interpreter service that is, it's called Language Line. So it's, you know, it's through
phone
the phone.
Based.
It's not,
yeah.
it's not in-person interpretation, but we also work with in-person interpretive services, particularly in places like Cumberland County and Kennebec County and in the Tri-County area in Androscoggin, where there are a lot of folks who use different languages. If folks are not, if their legal status is in question, that makes them more vulnerable because, of course, there's fear about calling law enforcement, you know, for many, many people, black and brown people, maybe poor people may not be excited about calling law enforcement, but for folks who are not, don't have a legal status, that's terrifying, you know?
Yes. If law enforcement was a danger to your health in mm-hmm. your foreign country, you know, you're probably not going to mm-hmm. feel super mm-hmm. casual about accessing it here.
Yeah.
And one thing I wanted yeah. to say is they can go to shelters regardless of their
yes.
their immigration status.
Yes.
That's really important to know.
Yes.
No one's going to ICE you
yes.
at the shelters.
Right. We are federally mandated to very strict rules around confidentiality, and so whoever's working with any of our domestic violence resource centers, we don't share that information with anyone else unless we have the survivor's permission. And there's a whole people sign releases to get that kind of permission. But in general, if someone even makes a phone call, it's not like we go and we don't tell anyone else. We don't share that with anyone else. But I also have to say that shelter is hard for anyone. I think particularly if you're coming from a culture that is not the same as the dominant culture here in Maine, because there may be cultural practices that are important some of which you might be able to carry into the shelter, but you may be concerned about whether or not you'll be accepted living with a bunch of strangers. I think it's really daunting option for so many people.
Do we have enough shelter space for people fleeing domestic violence in the state?
Well, most of our shelters remain full. What we tell survivors is to always call to see, to call and talk with an advocate to see if that's if going to shelter is really something that they want to do, and if there's availability. And you know, it's important to know that shelter is limited because we don't have enough space, but there are so many other ways that we work with survivors, you know, if they, doing just safety planning with them that doesn't include law enforcement, that doesn't include shelter, that maybe includes a protection from abuse order which doesn't involve law enforcement, or, just thinking about what other options they have and, maybe in their own communities, if they have trusted folks in their own communities.
Yeah. My heart aches for all the people who are so vulnerable that they would need to leave their homes in order to be safer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a big problem. How does mm-hmm. Maine stack up to other states in that department?
Mm.
Do we have more or less about the same as other New England states or other United States?
So we are What I can say is that our number of homicides that are domestic violence related are very high. When they're coming up with that number, they're not just counting the partners. They may also be counting the children. But our number is very high. I think it's roughly 40 to 50% of our homicides of women are domestic violence homicides. And that number is fluctuating. It may be trending downwards, but we usually give that range just because that's what it's been for a while. And that is not an exciting number. It's a very depressing number.
It's stunning to me. Mm-hmm. Beyond your being an advocate and an academic, you are also a black belt and a poet, which is an interesting combo. I wondered if you might like to share one of your poems or someone else's poem with us today as we close.
I would love to share someone else's poem. I have published many things, but publishing poetry is new for me, and it fills me with so much anxiety. And I'm not normally an anxious person. I will be doing a poetry reading February 6th at the Portland Ballet. A friend of mine is organizing a reading, and I'll be a feature. So people should look out for that. We're calling ourselves Renegade Writers. I think that's hilarious. So
your mom would be proud.
I hope so. That's all I can ever say when someone says things. I hope so.
Yeah. She was a bit of a renegade herself, wasn't she?
I think so. That's what I'm learning, you know.
Cool.
I would like to read an Audre Lorde poem Audre Lorde is so important to me. I'm wearing my A is for Audre Lorde shirt today. And so I'm going to read Litany for Survival. And it is a poem that speaks to me whenever I'm feeling nervous about telling the truth. All right. A Litany for Survival. For those of us who live at the shoreline, standing upon the constant edges of decision, crucial and alone. For those of us who cannot indulge the passing dreams of choice, who love in doorways, coming and going in the hours between dawns, looking inward and outward, at once, before and after, seeking a now that can breed futures, like bread in our children's mouths, so their dreams will not reflect the death of ours. For those of us who were imprinted with fear, like a faint line in the center of our foreheads, learning to be afraid with our mother's milk, for by this weapon, this illusion of some safety to be found, the heavy-footed hoped to silence us. For all of us, this instant and this triumph, we were never meant to survive. And when the sun rises, we are afraid it might not remain. When the sun sets, we are afraid it might not rise in the morning. When our stomachs are full, we are afraid of indigestion. When our stomachs are empty, we are afraid we may never eat again. When we are loved, we are afraid love will vanish. When we are alone, we are afraid love will never return. And when we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard nor welcomed. But when we are silent, we are still afraid. So it is better to speak, remembering we were never meant to survive.
Audre Lorde. Samah, you are a passionate advocate, an informed woman, and a truly beautiful person. Thank you so much for the work you're doing. And also thank you for being my guest at New Manner Speak today.
Thank you for having me. This was lovely. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. If you'd like to hear this complete interview or interviews from previous weeks, please visit newmannerspeak.com. I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that Samah has selected for us. Can you introduce this and tell us why you chose this song, Samah?
Sure. This is a song called Dala by Dobe Gnore. She is a musician, singer from Côte d'Ivoire. I saw her in concert back in, I'm going to say, maybe 2010, right before I moved here. And she is dynamic in concert. She's very acrobatic. And her voice is just melodic. It's beautiful.
Dobe is D-O-B-E-T. Mm-hmm. And it's G-N-A-H-O-R-E. Thanks, Samah.
Women on Biako Batambale. la che coco tre con la meteno leire le gnoli nende da la che coco tre con la meteno leire le gnoli nende
da la che coche pa ie da la che coche pa ba da la che coche pa ie da la che coche pa ba.
Quelle pame jolima, quadre con la, quelle pame jolima.